The challenge, the opportunity to connect. The 1960s, a time of imagination and change, a time of anger and fear. The 1960s, a program called Challenge.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Looked at our connections, our divisions, through the lens of faith. Nearly 60 years later, during these challenging times, we'll take a new look at our divisions, our connections, in a new program called Challenge 2.0. The United States has had more mass shootings than any other country in the world. One-third of all such killing sprees recorded internationally. In our last episode of Challenge 2.0, An Epidemic of Denial, we examined the scope and personal impact of the problem. In Part 2, we now examine what is being done, what more needs to be done, and the obstacles to reducing the death toll from what physicians term an avoidable public health crisis. So we are going to continue our discussion from last week on the issue of ownership of guns, gun-related violence, and we have four wonderful panelists who have agreed to be with us today who have considerable depth of experience in this, and each of you bringing the gift of a different perspective, and so I thank each of you for joining us again today. First, on my left, Bishop Greg Rickle, who serves as Bishop of the Diocese of Olympia of the Episcopal Church of Western Washington. We have Dr. Fred Rivera, who is a professor of pediatrics and epidemiology at the University of Washington at Seattle Children's Hospital. Paul Kramer, who served as citizen sponsor of the recently passed Initiative 1639 on gun purchase and ownership. We're going to hear more about that. And you speak with the perspective as the parent of a son who was wounded in a shooting incident in Mukilteo back in 2016. And then Rabbi Daniel Wiener, who is the senior rabbi at Temple to Hurst Sinai, who has been a guest here before. Glad we could talk you into coming again and joining us. And Temple to Hurst has campuses both in Seattle and Bellevue. So again, thank you, each one of you. Not assuming that those of you that are watching necessarily caught our program last week, Paul, I know it can never be easy to go back and revisit the experiences that directed you to essentially become involved with an issue you probably never expected that you would be involved with or have reason to be. Can you tell us what motivated you to become involved in this issue of gun safety?
Summer of 2016, my then 18-year-old son, Will, was at a gathering of friends in Mukilteo. 19 kids, good kids from good, loving homes. And a former classmate of theirs from high school showed up that night armed with an AR-15 with intentions to kill his ex-girlfriend and anyone else that she was associating with. He had texted a friend prior to the shooting, "I'm killing everyone at a huge party." My son was outside the house with three of his buddies, 15 others in the house, and the shooter went in, started firing. My son saw one of his friends, Jake Long, go down. My son took a bullet in the back and then dove into the dark backyard and got away before taking a second bullet from this rapid firing rifle. Another one of his buddies made it around the back of the house, and Jordan Ebner, going for the door to get into the house, was also shot down. The shooter went in and killed Anna Bowie. The others had scattered, went running and hiding to get away from the shooter. A couple went running down the driveway by the time the shooter was up on a balcony on the second floor, and thank God they were missed. He emptied his 30-round magazine. Shooting took place in 35 to 40 seconds. Three 19-year-olds, beautiful young people, full of potential to live happy, productive lives in this world, were murdered. My son was seriously injured, spent 17 days in Harborview Regional Trauma Center, surgery to reattach his collapsed lung. It was horrifying, traumatic, and heartbreaking. And I could never go back to life as it was after that. It was a calling that things were not right, and there needed to be a response, and I needed to use my voice to try to bring in some positive change in this world. Mm-hmm.
During the 2018 March for Life in Seattle, there were a number of people that held up signs, "We don't need your thoughts and prayers, we need action." What is your reaction when you hear what has become the standard response to something like that? "You have our thoughts and prayers." What's your personal response to that?
Honestly, I think we need both. Sincere thoughts and prayers make a difference from a sincere heart. It makes a difference. So please, when harm is done, send your thoughts and prayers. But we also need action to change what needs to be changed, so that it doesn't just keep happening. It's clear that the status quo is unacceptable. And we need to bring in further changes to reduce the level of violence in our society, in our culture. So yes, please, on the thoughts and prayers, but also meaningful action to change what needs to be changed.
I'm glad you said that, because I think it's important for people to understand that from a religious tradition, thoughts and prayers are not, you know, mere throwaway salutations and then your job is done. Thoughts and prayers, if they are sincere and sincerely intended, they evoke action, they evoke awareness, they demand and inspire us to have to do something to change the world and align it with God's vision for the world. So both are critical, but only if they're understood in a truly faith-oriented way.
Totally agree. Right after that March, we had our Chrism Mass, which is a Mass where we bless holy oils and renew vows for the priests, and I preached on that sign. If thoughts and prayers, I don't doubt the sincerity of people that offer that and say that that's what they're going to do, but I totally agree with the rabbi, it needs to lead to action. Mm-hmm. I would say even the prayers in my theology are not for God. If we believe God knows, God knows. We don't have to inform God of that. But the prayers are for us. They're to call us to action. If the action doesn't follow, then thoughts and prayers are pretty hollow.
Mm-hmm. From just going down the rabbit hole just a little bit theologically, in Judaism, the Hebrew
this
word,
will be fun.
Not too much. The Hebrew word for prayer is lehit palel, which has a reflexive meaning of kind of judging oneself and holding oneself accountable. Mm-hmm. And so prayer in and of itself is all about personal transformation, to be an agent for change. And if anything required significant change and a better alignment with God's vision for the world, it's this issue of gun violence.
Amen.
You probably have occasions to meet with public officials whose action within their public duties is very different from perhaps what they profess in their faith life. Have you ever had occasions to speak with some of these individuals and see how they reconcile those two differences?
Most of the people that I've been in touch with, and particularly those within relatively blue Washington State, really do see their work legislatively as an extension of their core values and their sense of duty and mandate within their position. So I think in other parts of the country, I think there is probably some significant dissonance or disconnect between what certain politicians will profess publicly and perhaps what they feel personally. I don't know, please.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely encountered that. I think it comes down to motivation and, what will get me elected next time. And, there is a greater good in that sometimes, thinking, what good can I do if I'm not here? So some of that rationalization comes in. So I definitely do see it. But I think at least the tact I try to take when I'm with people that are going down that line is that we need some reason in this. The extremes, we've got to get away from the extremes and find a reasonable center. One of the groups that I'm really a part of in Bishops Against Gun Violence, we actually are not calling for the end of guns. We think that's an unreasonable approach too. We are talking about a responsibility. Mm-hmm. And to bring reason to the discussion where we have safety and we have proper age limits and things like that, but not trying to do away with guns. So I think removing the extremes is the place I try to go with people when I have those conversations.
Danny, I get the sense, Rabbi, that you have something else.
No, I was just going to add that I think it's important that people also understand, and I see this within my own community, that the NRA does not necessarily reflect the vast population of thoughtful, common sense oriented responsible gun owners. I've spoken to a number of gun owners who have real problems with the NRA because mm-hmm. what used to be an organization that was about promoting gun safety and gun education is now a lobbying arm of the firearms industry and quite frankly the more extreme extreme elements of the Republican Party. If you look at NRA TV, it's much more about a critique of culture than it is about discussing firearm safety or education. And so I think it's really important to understand that the NRA has really abdicated and betrayed their original mission and is very disconnected from a significant portion of gun owners in this country.
Totally agree. I mean, people have noticed I'm from the South on this panel, but I was raised in the gun culture, the hunting culture, and at that point, NRA was exactly that. Right. It was a respected mm-hmm. organization that taught responsible gun ownership and use. And it's completely, I don't recognize it anymore.
And, you know, we live in a country that has a Second Amendment that gives people the right to own a firearm, at least how it's interpreted by the Supreme Court in the most recent decision, Heller. So we're not really talking about getting rid of guns. We're really just talking about how can we restrict access to guns by people who might harm themselves or others.
That brings up an excellent point, and I think it is. There seems to be this view of the Second Amendment as an absolute.
And, you know, the state of Florida passed a law to try to prevent physicians from asking patients about firearms. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, that law was eventually thrown out by the courts because it violated the doctor's First Amendment rights.
Well, and not all theologies would agree with this, but you know, I think that the absoluteness of that is also contextual. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to go back historically to look at the Second Amendment. It was a totally different time where defending oneself against armies coming in might have been actually a real concern. Mm-hmm. But that's not where we live now, not what we're dealing with now. And that's part of the reason I'm talking about, too, of bringing some reason into the discussion. So,
just this morning, I received an email, as we get many emails from different groups, and it was written by a young woman whose brother died in the Sandy Hook shootings. And she wrote, and discussed how the long-term emotional trauma that continues to be a reality in her life. Dr. Rivera, I know you've co-authored a publication on this issue. The cost doesn't end with a healing of the physical wounds, does it?
It does not. And we wrote an article that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And the reason was that in the space of a few days, two of the survivors from Parkland and a father of one of the children who died in mm-hmm. Sandy Hook took their lives. Mm-hmm. So there's a long-term effects of gun violence on lots of people. Just think about the children who were in Sandy Hook, mm-hmm. ages 5, 6, 7, and being exposed to that. That's clearly going to affect them for the rest of their lives. Look at the youth in Parkland. Mm-hmm. They have energized all of us by their advocacy for further restrictions of guns. But that event is really going to affect all of them for their lives. You know, the federal government has funded studies on people who survived the 9/11 attacks. But they haven't funded studies on the people who survived school shootings or Parkland mm-hmm. or Las Vegas or Orlando. We need to really better look at what's happened to those people. How can we best help them?
Mm-hmm. If somebody comes in and is treated for the injuries, you know, presuming they survive from this, or even their parents comes into a medical facility, are they given a referral for psychological, psychiatric, emotional counseling of some sort?
They should be. They're not always given that referral. Hopefully that's where their family doctor would enter into play. Mm-hmm. Family doctor who knows the patient, knows the family, can help to intervene if they sees them grieving, having post-traumatic stress, and refer them for appropriate care.
Paul, any perspectives on that?
Yeah, when my son was being treated at Harborview, he was visited by a psychologist and, you know, interviewed. So there was that care that was offered there. And my son seems to be doing very well. I have concerns about the other 15 young adults who were in the house that night with him. They had to run and hide for their lives. They came back out after the shooter was gone, saw their friends bleeding out. Sean, one of the young men, cries out to Jordan Ebner as he's bleeding out on the ground, "Jordan, don't go, don't go." And that's
their guilt.
Some of them have survivor's guilt. They've had a difficult time. Some of them, you know, going back to university, and like you found in your study, there's long-term effects.
And we don't think about that. We know that there's 39,000 people a year who die from firearms in the United States, but how many other people are affected by those events?
The family, the friends, the community. There are ripple effects that go out.
These events really aren't moments. They are constantly going on. They don't really end, I think.
Paul, not long after that shooting, you received a call from the state attorney general to go ahead and to speak out and to be a source of information. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and where that led?
Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson, at the time of the shooting in Mukilteo, summer of 2016, he had already drafted proposed legislation, a bill to be offered for consideration in the Washington State Legislature, banning AR-15 type assault rifles and high capacity magazines. Soon after the Mukilteo shooting, we're, you know, deep in grief, but also presented with an opportunity to help support something like that, to bring in change like that. I said yes, and, you know, went down, and there was a press conference and spoke at a press conference to help support that bill. There was additional work with Washington Ceasefire and the Attorney General testifying down at in front of the legislature, and that bill went nowhere. I did additional work with Moms Demand Action, Grandmothers Against Gun Violence, and then went back. The next year, Attorney General Bob Ferguson had drafted a revised bill that would raise the minimum age of purchase for semi-automatic assault rifles from 18 to 21, would require enhanced background checks. I think those were the two main features of his initial bill. That then morphed a little bit through the legislative session, especially after the Parkland shooting, to become, to include those features, but also some additional school safety measures. Testified in front of the legislature with renewed hope and optimism that things might now change. And again, the legislature failed to act. I was contacted about a year ago at this time, approximately, by the Alliance for Gun Responsibility about an initiative that they had drafted. And there was an opportunity to support that initiative as citizen sponsor. I took a look at the component. It was a sort of a fairly comprehensive package of gun violence prevention measures, all of which I was in support of, and happy to put my name behind it and my voice behind it to support that initiative, 1639, as a citizen sponsor, worked to help gather signatures with thousands of volunteers across Washington State, many speaking opportunities. And we passed that initiative, a comprehensive package, this past November. The key piece that's already was enacted January 1st was raising the minimum age of purchase from 18 to 21 for semi-automatic rifles. There's additional measures that will be put into effect July 1st of this year.
Now, Dr. Rivera, I know in our last episode we reviewed some of the statistics that have motivated medical professionals such as yourself to get involved in this. I believe it was the American College of Physicians that produced a position paper on gun violence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And we've mentioned the NRA before. What was their response to the medical profession?
The American College of Physicians, which represents the nation's internal medicine physicians, published a paper in a medical journal really stating what they thought was appropriate measures that should be done both by their members as well as by politicians. And it was things like asking families about whether they have guns in the home or not, mm-hmm. are they properly stored, as well as issues about lobbying for restrictions on access to guns by various at-risk individuals. It was a very reasoned paper. A week later, the NRA and their lobbying arm issued a statement saying that physicians didn't know what they were talking about and when talking about guns, and a physician should, quote, stay in their lane, end quote. Well, the surgeons, the emergency medicine doctors, the internists, the pediatricians didn't like that, because we take care of those individuals. Mm-hmm. We take care of them in our emergency rooms, in the operating rooms, in the hospitals. We see those patients in our offices. We feel it's our responsibility to talk to families about firearms. It is in our lane, and there's been tremendous pushback. And in fact, there was a meeting held by the American College of Surgeons in February, where 42 medical professional societies and the American Bar Association got together and issued a renewed statement about firearms. So this is very much in our lane. We view it as an important health problem, important public health problem.
Mm-hmm. Bishop Rickle, I think you spoke earlier in terms of your experience of having been a hospital administrator of the very real costs that our healthcare system faces as a result of the situation we find ourselves in right now.
Yeah, I mean, those have been around for a while. We've known that one of the biggest ways we could affect healthcare costs is by remedying some of the social ills that we have, gun violence being on the top mm-hmm. of the list. So I think this would solve a myriad of problems if we would actually tackle it and believe it, too. I think that's part of the problem right now.
We've done this with smoking and seatbelts.
Yes, that's exactly right.
There is precedent for looking at this
huge,
as an epidemic.
Advances.
Yes.
You know, the said seatbelts, I mean, motor vehicle fatalities have decreased dramatically in the United States per mile driven. The same has not happened for firearm injuries, and there's good reasons for that.
That's mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm.
Some, though certainly not all, of these shootings have been classed as mental health issues, or at least that it was a component of that. To what degree do each of you believe that's true, and to what degree does that simply serve to mask the larger issue that we've been talking about?
You know, I think mental health obviously comes into this quite often, but still the problem in the end result that we see and that we're talking about here is the access to that as a remedy in the mind of the person who's using it, whether they're mentally ill or not. Yes, we need to do a lot about mental illness, but that's not the beginning of the problem. It's an aspect of this problem.
I really think that people bring up the mental illness, it's a smokescreen.
Yeah.
All of us here would Absolutely. Agree that we do a poor job of providing mental health care
mm-hmm.
in the
mm-hmm.
state of Washington and the United States as a whole. No one would argue with that. Mm-hmm. We need to provide better mental health care. But the fact of the matter is that only about 4% of firearm assaults are committed by people who are mentally ill. And mentally ill people are much more likely to be victims of firearm injuries than be perpetrators.
Yeah, yeah.
So to blame it on the mentally ill is really diverting attention away from the problem of access to firearms.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree. Concur completely. Yeah. I think it is absolutely a political smokescreen.
What would each of you recommend that we do, including our viewers out there? And what are your personal next steps? Rabbi, I might start with you first.
I mean, the two most immediate things that come to mind, one is to support organizations like the Washington Alliance for Gun Responsibility and especially mm-hmm. other local organizations that have a proven track record and have had a significant impact. The other thing, quite frankly, is it's about the political calculus and equation. I think politicians have been resistant to these common sense changes in the most basic way because they fear the NRA and they fear the money that will be leveraged against them. Mm-hmm. And I think if we as a citizenry make it more costly for those politicians to resist common sense changes than to embrace them, that will have a direct impact.
I agree with the rabbi's comments in supporting the Alliance for Gun Responsibility. They're doing great work. Moms Demand Action, Grandmothers Against Gun Violence. There's a Washington State Firearm Tragedy Prevention Network, Washington Ceasefire. These are all organizations doing good work to reduce the level of gun violence in our culture.
I think there are two things I'd like the listeners to pay attention to. One is if you have firearms, store them safely. store them locked, unloaded, ammunition stored separately. That's number one. And number two is that, Paul mentioned how this individual, the shooter, had texted people, let them know his intent. We have now something called the Extreme Risk Protection Order, which was again an initiative in the state, that allows police and families to petition a judge to remove firearms from an individual who might harm themselves or others. Mm-hmm. In 2018, here in King County, that was only used 71 times. And 69 of those were done at the instigation of police. Only two were done at the instigation of families. Mm.
And that's another thing that people can do is contact their Washington state politicians or nationally to support that law as a national, federal law.
Don't listen to the sound bites. Don't listen to the NRA only, but get curious about this and learn about it and dig in beyond the sound bites. I would say people that are interested in the intersection of faith, especially Christianity, might look at the website of Bishops Against Gun Violence. We have as a goal to work against the unholy trinity of poverty, racism, and violence, especially as it relates to gun violence.
The need to have this discussion is not going to end here, but I thank each one of you for being a part of it today and hope you'll consider coming back as we begin to look at perhaps some different angles, some different aspects, perhaps some ways forward on this. So again, thank you so much for the work that each and every one of you is doing, and please do come back and join us again. And we would thank you for joining us on this episode of Challenge 2.0. We hope you'll tune in again next week. If you've enjoyed this program, please give us 5 stars and leave a review. If you can also tell one friend about the show, that would be great. You can find us on social media at Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find out more and financially support the show at PathsToUnderstanding.org. The program is hosted by executive producer Jeff Renner, produced by Tom Butterworth and John Sharifi. Cameras and audio by Rich McAdams, Tom Butterworth, and Dean Puccio. Ian Olson is the production assistant.